prison, how much work I've done in the community, one false move and I can be back in. And so that's what I always try to remind myself of, you know, that this is a daily fight and that I'm in it to try to help support as many people and put the prison out of business.
I have been speaking with Larry Turner and Will Johnson with Fresh Out Community-Based Reentry Program. You've been listening to Prison Pipeline, produced at the studios of KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline.
KBOO, Portland, on 90.7 FM. K282BH, Philomath, on 104.3 FM. And K220HR, Hood River, on 91.9 FM.
As I'm all in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews, stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
Connect with your favorite community radio station on social media.
Our Facebook page is facebook.com/kboomradio.
And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/kboo.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/kboo radio.
We also provide content to the free music archive,
an interactive library of high quality legal audio downloads.
That's at freemusicarchive.org/curator/KBOO.
You can find all of this and more on the KBOO website, kboo.fm.
Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroots News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
I'm Michelle Melton, and I'm an associate producer and technology reporter in Georgia, and I'm a millennial.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all of the things that go by, things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race. Welcome to another edition of Let's Talk About Race. This is our Pride and Prejudice show. However, we must adjust our preamble. We want to acknowledge the current threats of violence, the actual violence against the LGBTQ community. We have some religious leaders calling for death and books being banned that address the LGBTQ community. Life stories are being banned in schools and public libraries. There is a backlash, and Mary Lee provides us with an analysis.
So you ask me what's going on right now, why is this happening? It's a very simple response. This is fascism. This is fascism. This is fascism that is supported with white supremacy culture. Our ability as humans to lie to ourselves about ourselves, our motivations, our experiences, what we do and what we don't do, never ceases to amaze me. We are centering in this kind of backlash against queer people. We are centering white supremacy culture, and I include Black, Indigenous, and people of color there. And oftentimes, we don't even know it or realize it. The relationship of that centering of white as the right and the defining way that we understand humanity and humanity's rights and responsibilities is part and parcel of this response of separation, of oppression Olympics, of the rejection of the understanding of all of our lives being tied and part and parcel of one another. This is what is happening here. There, it has always been the case that we do this as human beings. I would say now there has actually been overt permission and invitation for that white supremacy culture, that white is right, to have emerged even more vociferously. And that's where you see actions that are discriminatory against gays and lesbians.
These attacks on the LGBTQ community may lead to self-hatred and suicide.
These kinds of statements may cause a young person to hate themselves and hate that part of themselves, and an increase in suicide. No one is talking about the impact these statements are having on other human beings. Do we have to wait until somebody's beloved daughter or son kills himself? And you can kill yourself a lot of different ways. Alcohol and drugs, destructive lifestyle, and then just the actual elimination of your own life.
Well, let's be clear. Our children and our brothers, sisters, siblings are killing themselves each and every day as a result of this issue in many of the ways that you just spoke to. If we aren't able to understand how our ancestors' histories and trauma, and I want to remind ourselves that trauma is the Greek word for wound, how that trauma has manifested itself in our own traumas over the years, completely unconsciously, we don't stand a chance of being able to unpeel or peel back those layers of hurt that are causing us to act in certain ways, including the ways in which we practice self-harm. Because we have been taught the same messages, which is we are unworthy, we are not white, we are not the right, we are subhuman in many ways. And the evidence is overwhelming. It is an act of resistance and an act of survival for us as particularly people of color to learn about that, to actively fight against it, address it, sit with the trauma until we are able to move beyond it and understand how it motivates us to do or not do certain things or act or not act. And once that happens, I believe we will be more fully able to embrace our own communities, children, our brothers, sisters, siblings, and those of the white queer movement.
And do you think it's just a matter of time, and it's already occurring, where they're banning books on diversity, on equality, history of people of color?
There's so much research that shows once I make a human connection to another human being and that connection is real and sincere and understands our shared humanity, we are unable to hate on the other person, to discriminate against them based on their differences from me. And you look at the organizing and the activism of the queer movement in years past was all around making sure that everybody knew they knew somebody who was gay or lesbian. They might not know it consciously, and asking people who were gay or lesbian to come out so that folks could realize that there was not a subhuman, a monster, an unknowable other that we were talking about when we talked about gay rights and liberation. It was actually my colleague at work. It was my friend at church. It was my daughter's, my niece or my nephew. So the ability to prevent people from understanding the humanity of queer people, of gays and lesbians, bi and transsexual, is strategic. When we don't understand humanity, when we don't have a relationship, it is way too easy for us to be able to other and to say, yeah, that's not me, and there's no rights that are necessary there because that's not me, and I know my own struggles, I know my own issues. So it's not surprising to me that this book banning is part of this march towards fascism. And we are, some would say we're already there, we are marching, you know, hell-bent for leather towards fascism. This is part of the agenda. And we talk a lot about this. It's not accidental. This is not somehow coincidental, and you got a few people who had a few bad ideas, and they're getting their time on the airways. This is not accidental. This is absolutely strategic. It is a strategy that was developed and put together over many, many years' time, and you've seen the right continue to work it. And I want to say that this strategy was based in white supremacy culture and racism, even as we talk about the rights for gays and lesbians and other queer people. We start and we end with white supremacy culture and racism, and that is the backdrop under which all of the rest of this oppressive and fascist behavior occurs. And that's what we must keep our eyes on in terms of strategy and activism, which is that. And when we deny the basis of this particular type of oppression within white supremacy culture and racism against people of color, we are not only not being strategic, I think we're being ineffective and possibly unable to mount a response.
Well, what can we do? You know, we're going to hear more and more of this. We're going to have book bannings in our own libraries all across the country. What can we do?
Well, I think a couple of things. One of the conversations I had today was that repair from trauma has to be communal, not individual. And we've talked a lot about this. Are we talking about individual interpersonal relationship, or are we talking about systemic and structural? I believe we have to talk about systemic and structural. And I think we have to talk about systemic and structural, particularly as it relates to healing from trauma and repair work. And Resma makes the point that you have to do that not only because we've got to get up at the structural level, but because the trauma and the harm was not individual. And the more we think about something bad happening to this individual person here, or violence done on that individual person's level, without understanding how it manifests in a structural analysis, the more we're missing the point and the less effective we're going to be. So the repair work must be communal. Now, I don't know what that looks like. I have to tell you that I am fairly ambivalent about pride and pride marches. And that has changed for me over time, perhaps understandably or reliably. I see too much of these pride celebrations and marching basically espousing, not from everyone, but in general, espousing an ethos that says my liberation is the ability to act like cisgender white people. So I get to get married, I get to have kids, I get to, you know, have the cocktails I want, I get to be courted as a marketing demographic. And I want to be clear that my liberation and the liberation of the queer people of color that I know is not simply defined as having access to what cis white people have access to. That is not liberation in my mind, and it is another way in which we are centering white as right here. We have confused and conflated pride celebrations over time from what I believe was liberatory action and a dream for liberation into, I want to have what white people have, I want to have what cisgender people have, I want to have what straight people have, and when I got that,
I got my liberation and let's go have a cool party. So I feel pretty ambivalent about that. I believe in the approach that says our healing from trauma needs to be communal. I'm not sure what that looks like until there's some interrogation of the white queer movement, their leaders, their purpose, their agenda that holds it accountable for white supremacy culture. Until that happens, I'm not sure we can heal communally.
You are listening to LTAR's Pride and Prejudice, the backlash against the LGBTQ community. Our silence against threats made to the queer community is unacceptable.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
Althea, and you found it rather offensive when I said, are members of the gay and queer community the new N-words, meaning that it's okay to denigrate them, to threaten their lives, to ban books? And if they come for me in the morning, they'll be coming for you in the afternoon.
I think I chafed against the phrasing that you used, but I understand very well what it is you mean and how rhetoric around queer and trans folks has changed in this country in the past couple of years. We've seen a real shift, a real backlash. And I think it can be extremely, extremely disheartening to folks. Over the past year, we saw these white nationalists attempt to break up a pride rally in Idaho. Break up is really a soft term for it. They intended violence. We also saw in concurring opinions in the Supreme Court case that overturned Roe versus Wade that there was energy towards overturning the right to marry whoever you like. There is backlash out there, and there, especially in southern states and Republican-controlled areas, backlash against teachers, backlash against queer community members that have done nothing wrong, that play into old tropes about what does it mean to be not heterosexual and cisgendered. It's certainly disturbing, but I think it's also important to recognize that every bit of progress has to continue to be fought for. It's not something that's a one and done type of deal. There's not often that we decide on something one time and the conversation ends there. If that were the case, we'd still be in separate but equal under Plessy versus Ferguson, right? And it's important to understand that the progress that has been made must be defended, because while it may seem old hat to liberals, progressives, majority of Americans to have real life prejudice against gay people, it's not over in that sense.
Now, you mentioned that we're recording this during a historical recognition of gay rights in America.
Yes, October is LGBTQ History Month, and the erasure of LGBTQ folks from history is prevalent, and it's something that continues to evolve with scholarship today. There is more and more of our history of those pivotal folks throughout the globe that were LGBTQ and were part of that community and lived their lives, you know, depending on their times, you know, and that more and more that understanding that LGBTQ folks have always been a part of our society and in, you know, non-Western cultures have had more frequently an enshrined role and had much more respect than the way that Western quote-unquote society tends to treat those things.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race,
internationally awarded Best Audio Podcast and Best Audio Production at the Swedish International Film Festival, Ediplay International Film Festival in France, Echo Nation Audio and Film Festival in Greater Manchester, England, Bright International Film Festival in London, and at the Fourth Dimension Independent Film Festival in Bali, Indonesia. Let's Talk About Race is an intergenerational roundtable discussion of independent journalists who engage in rigorous conversations and analysis of news coverage regarding the role race plays in politics, government, the economy, education, and health. And now, back to our show.
You are listening to LTAR's Pride and Prejudice, the Backlash Against the LGBTQ Community. Our silence against threats made to the queer community is unacceptable.
At least 18 transgender women of color have been murdered.
It's not just murders. Countless more of my trans brothers and sisters have survived brutal attacks. It's a subject deeply personal to me as someone fighting for transgender visibility, with many in my community wondering, am I next?
Three people are facing hate crime charges after the Broward State Attorney's Office says they attacked a man due to his sexual orientation. The State Attorney's Office says August 6th of 2021, the 31-year-old man was beaten so badly that he is now permanently blind.
This was a riotous group that had prepared in advance to come downtown and disrupt either the Pride event or the Prayer in the Park event.
All wearing blue khakis.
Those arrested wearing nearly identical clothing ranged in age from 20 to 40 and were from about a dozen states. No one was from Coeur d'Alene. Authorities recovered gear, including shields, shin guards, and a smoke grenade.
Pastor Dylan Oz gave a statement calling for the execution of gay people. This is audio from part of that sermon.
They should be convicted in a lawful trial. They should be sentenced with death. They should be lined up against the wall and shot in the back of the head.
You are listening to LTAR's Pride and Prejudice, the Backlash Against the LGBTQ Community. Our silence against threats made to the queer community is unacceptable.
Back to our Pride Month show, hosted by our faith reporter, Nia Gray.
So we'll start with Cecil. Welcome to the show, Cecil. And I was hoping that you could give us a little bit more historical context on Pride Month.
Thank you so much, and for the opportunity to engage in this conversation. As a queer Black man, Pride has been an important part of our history. And as you said in your introduction, Pride Month began in 1969 when there was a rebellion at the Stonewall Bar in the Village in New York City. And so I think it's good to remind ourselves when we are often think of Pride as brought to you by major corporation, that Pride began when Marsha P. Johnson stood up and threw a brick at a police vehicle because of grievances that trans and queer people were having against police raiding their safe places. A poem by Carence Cole goes like this. Pride exists because of a woman. Pride exists because of a Black woman. Pride exists because of a Black trans woman. Pride exists because of a Black trans woman who was a sex worker. Pride exists because of a Black bisexual trans woman who was a sex worker that threw a brick at a cop. Pride exists because of a Black bisexual trans woman who was a sex worker that threw a brick at a cop and started a riot against the state. Don't lose this month in rainbow capitalism and unabashed racism because of the privilege of being white while queer. If you aren't supporting queer people of color, trans women, and queer sex workers, you aren't celebrating Pride. You are celebrating rainbow capitalism and police brutality. Her name was Marsha P. Johnson. And that's a poem by Carence Cole, which I think can frame our discussion about pride and what it means to talk about the intersection of justice issues.
Marsha P. Johnson is remembered as an activist and free spirit, with flowers or Christmas lights in her hair, and said to be one of the first rioters at Stonewall in 1969. Before the term transgender entered the lexicon, Marsha called herself a transvestite or a drag queen.
When I became a drag queen, I started to live my life as a woman.
During her life, she and other trans activists struggled to be fully accepted in the gay community, which often excluded trans people. Marsha was often homeless, supporting herself through sex work and repeatedly arrested, but she attracted many friends to help her. A fellow activist once saw Marsha asleep under a table of lilies at a flower shop. The employees welcomed her because they thought she was holy. Once, a judge asked Marsha what the P in her name stood for. She explained,
"Pay no mind Johnson. Marsha, pay no mind Johnson."
The judge, charmed, said, "And that's exactly what I'm going to do." She was released. She was well known in New York's Greenwich Village, where she became an icon after the Stonewall riots.
I was one of the first girls to ever come in drag to Stonewall. 1969, when the Stonewall riots started, that's when I started my rioting.
As one story recounts, during the riots, Marsha threw a shot glass into a mirror at the bar after police entered, shouting, "I got my civil rights." Marsha was a founding member of the Gay Liberation Front, and she formed STAR in 1970 with Sylvia Rivera, a transgender woman and activist. It was revolutionary in its direct support for the trans community. Together, they opened STAR House, a shelter for homeless LGBTQ youth. She was also an advocate for those affected by HIV and AIDS, and rejected the stigma and shame associated with the virus.
I think you should stand as close to them as you can and help out as much as you can. Including myself, I have HIV.
She remained devoted to her Christian faith throughout her life. Friends say she could be found praying in various churches, at times dressed in velvet, throwing glitter. Marsha died in 1992 at the age of 46. At the time, police said she'd taken her own life, a claim friends disputed.
I mean, it's hard for me to believe that she would commit suicide.
The case was reopened in 2012 as a possible homicide. Like Marsha, trans women continue to suffer from long-standing discrimination and violence. Her legacy reflects the ongoing struggle for transgender people to be safe and receive equal rights.
People to realize that we're all brothers and sisters and human beings and a human race.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, internationally awarded Best Audio Podcast and Best Audio Production at the Swedish International Film Festival, Eddie Play International Film Festival in France, Echo Nation Audio and Film Festival in Greater Manchester, England, Bright International Film Festival in London, and at the Fourth Dimension Independent Film Festival in Bali, Indonesia. Let's Talk About Race is an intergenerational roundtable discussion of independent journalists who engage in rigorous conversations and analysis of news coverage regarding the role race plays in politics, government, the economy, education, and health. And now, back to our show.
Professor Johnson?
Well, I appreciate that sort of historical context that Cecil gave us about, you know, the efforts of Marsha Johnson. And in thinking about the intersectionality of social justice movements and where pride fits in, there seems to be this duality, because social injustices tend to have some common framework, some common impact on people that, you know, different, whether it's race, but also I think what the LGBTQ community experiences is different. And so when we're looking at intersectionality, one of the things that seems so important to me is to recognize that being Black and gay is different, and the experiences will be different than when we're talking about racial social injustice. So as we look at intersectionality, we don't want to lose the fact that there are some disparity in treatment.
Althea?
So thinking about intersectionality in Pride Month, I think, is super important because it tells us that systems of oppression are all tied up together. We can't pull them apart from each other. They're inextricably linked. And that's super important to recognize this month, as, you know, some of my colleagues here have mentioned, with the corporatization of Pride, the ubiquity of the rainbow flag isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it's important to circle back to those radical roots, because as much as there have been major accomplishments and major strides in terms of both like legal rights of LGBTQ people and you know, generalized acceptance of people with different identities, obviously, there's still a lot of fight left to do. And without recognizing that radical core of Pride, I think people can get complacent. It isn't to say that it shouldn't be a celebration, but rather to recognize that rights are rarely, if ever, given. They're won. And there's a number of very like clear and present struggles that LGBTQ people are facing right now, whether that is rights that need to be pushed forward, for example, protecting against healthcare discrimination or discrimination in housing, but also there's a great number of bills in state legislatures right now trying to restrict trans youth and their access to playing sports and being able to use the locker room that matches their gender identity. And that's because bathroom bills failed a couple years ago. And that fight is now focused on young trans people, people who are discovering their gender identity and trying to limit them in that way. So there's a lot of topics that are worth considering this month, that it's a celebration, yes, but that there is still a lot of work to be done to forward rights for LGBTQ people.
And Black LGBTQ community members of the community not only face discrimination outside of the community, but also they face it inside of the Black community, which has led to increased homelessness, increased suicide, families and communities rejecting them. I'll just open this up to the group, whoever wants to chime in. Where do you think this comes from, and where do we go from here to help support the LGBTQ community, folks that are in our families and in our neighbors?
It must be stated that part of this homophobia that we see in the Black community is a residue of the acceptance of white norms, particularly in terms of religion. It is important to recognize not only the power of the Black Church in movements for liberation, but also the power of the Black Church in preventing movements of liberation. And so much of the homophobia we experience in the Black community is because of the preaching that we hear out of the Black pulpits Sunday after Sunday, which denigrates, shame, and participate in the violence against LGBTQ plus people. I think it's important to recognize that and call it out and not be ashamed, and to call the church to a higher purpose. And it is necessary to challenge the church on this matter because of its historic influence and the need to transform the church and the church's teaching.
And the Black church has a sort of unspoken don't ask, don't tell rule when it comes to gender identity. Professor Johnson, do you have any comments about that, or what would you like to say about that?
I would agree that the position that the Black Church has taken on homosexuality has been very detrimental to the LGBTQ community. I would also say that when entering in discussions with people of faith that they have offered in return to being challenged on that position scripture, and that they have interpreted scripture in a way that supports their position. And to me, it's just an example of how we can, I think, blind ourselves from listening to the truth and sort of moving forward and understanding. And it's almost hypocritical, in my view, to take the position that I've seen in some Black churches. I also wanted to comment on the disparate treatment that we see and how it impacts our young Black youth in terms of higher suicide, and that wealth gap, it contributes to access to health, to access to education. It's just in so many ways, it's negatively has impacted our young people. And I think we really need to stand up within our faith communities and really be a voice for this has to change, especially for the power that Black churches have.
You are listening to LTAR's Pride and Prejudice, the backlash against the LGBTQ community. Our silence against threats made to the queer community is unacceptable.
I guess I just wanted to point out, you know, that on this show, we talk about, you know, white supremacy and bigotry in that regard. And we talk a little bit about, you know, patriarchy and misogyny, but I think this is a great opportunity for us to talk about those other hierarchies being heterosexuality and cisgender supremacy, and understanding that queer liberation isn't about assimilation into, just like anyone's liberation, isn't assimilation into that so-called norm. It's actually the acceptance and the proliferation of anything except that norm.
Cecil, would you like to add something?
Yes, this discussion is really important, as the other panelists have stated, and as Althea just mentioned, in terms of looking at how oppression manifests itself in many ways in our society. We also need to lift up people who continue to suffer. We need to center the experience of trans women, celebrating who they are and the struggle they go through, and recognize the challenges they face.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning progressive intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Professor Johnson?
I think the panelists have covered this pretty well. And the only comments that I would add go back to your information about people in other countries feeling like they're getting, or I think you were referring to younger people in other countries feeling like they're getting more support in terms of you know, being non-binary or gender conforming. But I also think that there are a lot of countries where not conforming is death. And I'm thinking of Nigeria specifically. There's some cases there where people have literally had to flee for their lives, as well as many Muslim countries. So I guess for as many that feel supported, there are many more that this is life-threatening. And so globally, I think there's so much work to be done.
And finally, an intersection that I think people of color and the LGBTQ trans community can find common ground with is this issue of, you know, police brutality, the alarming rates with transgenders, but also gay, lesbian, non-binary people of color are also harassed and more likely to be arrested and also more likely to sort of be ignored by law enforcement. If they need to utilize law enforcement, you know, they're dismissed in domestic violence situations or situations where they don't feel safe. So I just wanted to ask the panel, I know that the Black Lives Matter organization on their website identifies and elevates trans and LGBTQ lives. However, when we see the protests and when we see where the real focus is, do all Black lives matter? We'll start with Cecil.
That's a good question. Do all Black lives matter? I think it's important to remember how those who have experienced oppression are often the leaders, often those who are first able to speak out. We know this historically, how speaking in terms of the civil rights struggle in the United States, queer Black men and women were often in the forefront, at least initially in the liberation struggle. Currently, the recent movement of Black Lives Matter has often been led by queer women of color, and we need to acknowledge that and say it clearly and plainly. I think it's important also to see how we need to put those voices, those experiences at the center as we're talking about police brutality, police reform, or the abolition of policing as we know it. I think if we center the voices of those who are most likely to be victim and their experiences, LGBTQ people, then we will be able to make a much more creative and transformative way in which we can reimagine community safety.
Althea.
Yeah, I would echo what Cecil said there 100%. And, you know, thinking about the issue of police brutality is definitely one that can unite oppressed people of all stripes, because the police is a force of oppression, right? Like, they uphold the ideals that are opposite. So that's where the idea of intersectionality comes in and is so informative, is seeing those overlapping systems that lead to worse outcomes for folks who are at the intersection of more of these systems. And it's important to center those folks in all of these discussions, but also, you know, not let them fall by the wayside when we're talking about police brutality.
Professor Johnson.
I see that policing is a common factor, and I think this was said previously, for all people in terms of social justice. One of the common factors where we really see things play out unfairly is with policing. And I think it has to do with policing was never about protecting Black people or about protecting the LGBTQ community. It was about protecting white people and their property. So as we experience it now, philosophically, it was never intended to serve and protect when it comes to these marginalized communities. It's correct to say that there's also this sort of hierarchy in when we talk about Black Lives Matter. And I think I was trying to get at this a little earlier and maybe not articulating it very well, that to be Black and a part of the LGBT community is not the same as being Black. And I think there are even a greater threat for that community, and that we need to find a way to position ourselves to protect and really advocate for all impacted communities, but there's even greater impact within our LGBT community that we have to be advocates for, we have to be allies for.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
What didn't we talk about this week, panel?
That as we focus on LGBTQ plus communities this week, what we did not talk about, how HIV/AIDS has impacted the Black community and the LGBTQ plus community. This is the 40th anniversary when scientists first announced strange disease that was impacting gay men in the San Francisco and New York region. What we did not talk about was how for most of the next decade, the federal administration, the president, Ronald Reagan, refused to say the word AIDS. What we did not talk about was in the midst of that horrible disease and epidemic, that it was communities coming together and protecting and saving the lives, whether it was in forming soup kitchens and meals or clothing. The community supported gay men as they suffered through that first decade of that epidemic. So what we did not talk about this week was also how community organizations such as ACT UP became a barometer of not only what was happening in the community, but also pointed a way in which activism would take place in the following couple of decades.
You are listening to LTAR's Pride and Prejudice, the backlash against the LGBTQ community. Our silence against threats made to the queer community is unacceptable.
Althea?
What we didn't talk about, well, it was mentioned briefly, but the onslaught of bills in various state legislatures in the U.S. that are barring specifically transgender girls from competing in high school sports. I believe the Republican governor of Florida signed that into law on the first day of Pride Month, despite the fact that there was no case that he could point to of a transgender girl competing against a cisgender girl in high school sports. And just thinking about, you know, the broader context of this current attack on trans girls specifically, that it's sort of looking, it's fishing, Republicans fishing around for a problem, trying to use young people in a sort of culture war. Folks need to get educated and not have knee-jerk reactions to things that they don't understand, especially when it's this reactionary sort of policy that denies the humanity and the rights of young people.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race.
Previously on Let's Talk About Race.
Home is where the violence is. Domestic violence in America. The most dangerous time in a relationship is when a woman wants to leave. Half of women who die by homicide in America are killed by an intimate partner or a family member. This is a pandemic within a pandemic.
Women would leave if they could leave, but they have no place to go.
In essence, at that moment in time, the violence that has been so effective for the abuser to be using against his victim has failed, because the evidence of an autonomy or a self-determination or an ability to say, nope, I actually am worth it, I actually can move, I actually shall move, is almost pushing it in the face of the abuser that your abuse has failed. Your attempt to control this person has failed to the extent that they are contemplating or struggling or trying or actually leaving you. And that is part of why I think it's a particularly dangerous time. Because we're not looking at root causes, we are not able to understand what it would take to change and end this kind of violence. Heterosexual marriage was an institution of property, was an institution of economics, and was an institution by the means of which men controlled production up until including children. So it's an economic imperative that there be this, you know, contract. I mean, women were chattel to be brought into a relationship and a dowry paid. I mean, if you look at all of these trappings of heterosexual marriage and that institution, it was economics.
The conversation is focused on the woman and not the man. What is wrong in this culture that we produce men who are violent?
I know plenty of men who really revere their mothers. They revere their mothers, but not in their capacity as women, but as someone who provides for them and loves them unconditionally. And it kind of plays into this Madonna horror complex, where because the mother is a non-sexual figure in one's life, there is a special reverence for that. And when you're encountering women elsewhere out in the world and sex and sexuality is introduced, there's a framework of understanding that divides women's humanity into Madonnas and whores. And Madonnas are to be respected and whores are not worth it. It prevents men in many ways from seeing the complex human person, the humanity of the women in their life, and that the cycle continues because they can never find a woman who is their mother, who will unconditionally love them and serve them in all of the ways that a parent does, because that's a parent. That's not an adult romantic relationship. It's very troubling. But it is something that can be pieced apart if you're interested in doing the work. There was a question posed in some of the reading that I did about this, was thinking about the people in your life, thinking about the women in your life, thinking about your partners. What is it that you like about them that has nothing to do with the ways in which they serve you? And that isn't to say, you know, someone who's generous or a good listener shouldn't be valued for those things, but understanding what is it about the people in my life, and not to say that you should cut anybody out for any of those things, but to understand somebody complexly, what is it that is inherent about them that I enjoy aside from they're a great cook, or they always listen to my problems, or they pay for a bunch of stuff that I'm really interested in doing, or any number of things like that, I think is an interesting place to start in figuring out what is it that I really value in somebody else that doesn't have to do with the ways that they are serving me.
That was an excerpt of our episode, Let's Talk About Race, The Second Pandemic, Domestic Violence in America. All of our back episodes can be found on SoundCloud by searching Let's Talk About Race, LTAR.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, internationally awarded Best Audio Podcast and Best Audio Production at the Swedish International Film Festival, Eddie Play International Film Festival in France, Echo Nation Audio and Film Festival in Greater Manchester, England, Bright International Film Festival in London, and at the Fourth Dimension Independent Film Festival in Bali, Indonesia. Let's Talk About Race is an intergenerational roundtable discussion of independent journalists who engage in rigorous conversations and analysis of news coverage regarding the role race plays in politics, government, the economy, education, and health. And now, back to our show.
I have sat through so many reboots of Mission Impossible that I want my time back. However, I thought the new reboot of MI could use a little dose of reality. If it did, it would sound something like this.
Good morning, Mr. Hunt. Your mission, and you have no choice but to accept it, is to live on a fixed income. You no longer have any team members because you got them all killed, or they died trying to protect you. And you gave your fortune to a religious organization, and your private health insurance was canceled due to too many broken bones, too much exposure to radiation, and too many severe head traumas. You now have to live within a fixed income, and your state-of-the-art car has been replaced with public transportation. Instead of chasing terrorists and criminals, you will walk with your adult walker to the food bank at the end of every month. You must stop your low-income rental apartment from being turned into condos. Additionally, you may have to fight with other low-income neighbors over pop bottles and other recyclables. As always, should you be unable to avoid homelessness, illness, or injury, the society will disavow all knowledge and responsibility for your life. This message will never self-destruct and will become institutionalized in society. Good luck, Mr. Hunt, and don't make this a mission impossible.
Sometimes listening to the news seems like one trauma dump after another. Therefore, at Let's Talk About Race, we've created a new segment entitled Hope is a Thing with Feathers.
Barack Obama is halfway to an EGOT. The former president won an Emmy Award to go with his two Grammys. Obama won the Best Narrator Emmy for his work on the Netflix documentary series Our Great National Parks. The five-part show, which features national parks from around the globe, is produced by Barack and Michelle Obama's production company, Higher Ground. Barack Obama is the second president to have an Emmy. Dwight D. Eisenhower was given a special Emmy in 1956. Barack Obama previously won Grammy Awards for his audiobook reading of his two memoirs, The Audacity of Hope and Dreams from My Father. Michelle Obama won her own Grammy for reading her audiobook in 2020. EGOT refers to a special category of entertainers who have won an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and a Tony. To date, 17 people have done it. So while one former president is lying about the 2020 election, another president is aging gracefully. Jimmy Carter just turned 98 years old. Another former president, George Bush, is hiding out on his ranch due to starting an unnecessary war in the Middle East. Former President Barack Obama continues to promote the beauty of America and what is best in the American people.
A fish that can walk. Surfing hippos want to catch the waves. Species found nowhere else on Earth. Join me in this celebration of our planet's greatest national parks and wilderness. Around the world, the more isolated the national park, the more unusual its creatures, and the more extraordinary their behaviors. Ooh, When humanity started to protect these wild places, we did not realize how important they would become. They're a haven for endangered species and a hotbed for scientific research. This sloth has an entire micro-kingdom living in his fur. Researching him will help fight cancer, malaria, and antibiotic-resistant superbugs. This sleepy sloth might just save us all. But we got that. As a journey through the natural wonders of our shared birthright.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things. Talk about things that make
Race. Race. Race.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by
Grassroot News Northwest. Catch previous episodes on Apple Podcasts or SoundCloud under LTAR or Let's Talk About Race.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Support for this program comes from KBOO listeners and Grand Lodge Concerts, presenting Leftover Salmon, Railroad Earth, and Yonder Mountain String Band live in Forest Grove on Thursday, June 22nd. Information and tickets for Yonder Mountain String Band, Railroad Earth, and Leftover Salmon at GrandLodgeConcerts.com.
This is
KBOO Portland.
You are about to cross the border.